Welcome to The Common Health, the podcast of the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security. In it, we delve deeply into the puzzle at home and abroad that connects pandemic preparedness and response, HIV/AIDS, routine immunization, primary care, and the geopolitical impacts these have on human and national security. The Common Health replaces under a single podcast the Coronavirus Crisis Update, Pandemic Planet, and AIDS Existential Moment. Please join me, J. Stephen Morrison, and my co-hosts, Catherine Bliss and Andrew Schwartz, as we explore this new era of health security and what it means for U.S. leadership. This is The Common Health. I'm delighted again to be able to welcome a good friend, Mitch Wolfe, who is with us here in from London. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Very happy to be here.
Let me just introduce you briefly. Mitch is a retired Rear Admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service, former Chief Medical Officer at CDC, running the Washington, D.C. office for several years, served overseas as Director of the CDC office in both Vietnam and in Bangkok, Thailand. He's now based in London, private consultant, involved in a biotech startup. So it's terrific to have you back here. He's also a very active member of the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security, for which we're really grateful. Let's start with the global writ of CDC. This is something you've given a lot of thought to, and you've left quite a legacy in our understanding of what CDC's fit is in terms of its global mission. And you've played a very strong leadership role in the creation of, I think it's now four regional offices, soon to be six around the world. Let's talk, first of all, about the genesis of the concept for the regional offices and how does that fit in the larger mission, in your view?
Sure. So I think it's important that everyone understand that CDC needs to be involved in global health to protect national security, right? And the link between global and national health. And I think that the COVID pandemic has really shown us that the inextricable link between global and domestic health. In looking over the CDC global strategy, we wanted to ensure that we would have long-term overseas presence. The country offices that have been developed are very important, and there's no substitute for having that daily interaction with local partners and local Ministry of Health and the local embassies. But a lot of those staff are funded by programs that were not necessarily going to be permanent. And we wanted to get a long-term permanent overseas presence and did that by establishing a series of regional offices. And the regional offices had several purposes. As I said, one of them is a long-term overseas presence. We also wanted to be able to have coverage where we didn't have a lot of coverage before. And the first regional offices were in Central and South America and Eastern Europe and Central Asia and in Middle East and North Africa, where we didn't have a lot of presence. And in addition, it was a way of getting senior staff out into the field to develop regional strategies. And there's really no substitute for having people out in the field. And to be able to have some technical expertise that we'd be able to position regionally, but that we may not be able to have in every...
Give us some examples, like what kind of high technical expertise did you want to have within that regional office for deployment around the region?
Right. So a couple of examples is we weren't able to have a pan-respiratory expert in every country office, but we could in every regional office. And I know CDC is moving to put a pan-respiratory expert in every office. And also a workforce specialist. You know, increasing the capacity of workforce in countries is a critical part of pandemic preparedness and response globally. And so being able to put a workforce specialist in those offices. So those were some of the reasons that we established these regional offices as a supplement to the country offices that were already existing.
Let me ask you a related question to that. I mean, it seems to me that a regional office gives you the opportunity to have higher visibility and presence within the region. It provides a diplomatic opportunity for leadership, and I wanted you to talk about that. And it's occurring in a period when geopolitics is shaping a lot of our behavior in all sorts of places and where our alliances are becoming extremely important to us, the G7 has been transformed under the pressure of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That has had a bounce effect in all sorts of public health engagement. We are expanding our regional activities and our partnerships and alliances in Asia, where we have multiple historical treaty partners. And that also raises the game in terms of, if global health security is a national security and global security matter, then you'd think as these offices are forming up that they are going to have more of a diplomatic effort at forging new partnerships that align closely with what the new geopolitical realities are. Say a bit about that. Am I accurate in characterizing this?
Yeah, absolutely accurate. So I think one thing COVID has shown everybody is that global health and politics are inextricably linked. And I think you can't really necessarily separate them, but need to know how to work with each other to affect the best outcome. And I think it's very important that CDC get involved in policy and strategy as much as possible. So that's also true of overseas. And so these offices are going to engage with regional bodies. For example, you mentioned Asia. So ASEAN is an important and strong regional body that our regional offices engage with. And they have a lot of plans for emergency preparedness and response in Asia. In addition, I think that, you know, it's important maybe that CDC and U.S. government health be in places that maybe we weren't before, because it's not just a development issue. It's a technical and national security issue. So that's where opening offices, for example, the CDC regional office in Japan is very important. It's going to be mainly a collaboration office rather than a technical office, but it's absolutely critical for CDC and for U.S. national security.
So CDC is not a development agency. It's not creating offices like USAID would be creating. It is a partnership, collaboration, technical expertise, diplomatic leadership function.
Correct. And we need to work with, CDC needs to work with all countries in order to improve global health security. You know, it's not just with low and middle income countries. And again, the COVID pandemic showed us that the pandemic did not originate and propagate just in low and middle income countries. So it's very important that we work with all countries, both in their country, regionally, and globally, to improve global health security. It's not solely a development issue.
I would think that having these regional offices gives you proximity. You're close to the areas that are most of greatest interest. If you're near an area that is in conflict or unstable, in terms of the networks within the region, the knowledge of what's happening becomes terribly important, the presence. I mean, talking to the director of the regional office in Georgia, Charles Vitek, who came by recently, it was very clear that being in the region was terribly important in trying to understand the evolution of issues within Ukraine during the course of this war. Maybe not inside, but the proximity gives you access to networks, to information flows. You build relations, you begin to understand. And now in the case of the war front in Ukraine, we've got really serious AMR, antimicrobial resistance problems in the clinics and hospitals. So trying to track that phenomenon, which has much bigger significance than simply what's going on within Ukraine, becomes a big issue. And having a regional capacity to pull in, to talk to people, to try to get samples, to try to track this, figure out what technical expertise is most appropriate. What's it going to take for these regional offices in terms of staffing, career pathways, budgets? Because they have to really have strong support from back in Washington. They have to have, as you point out, long-term serious funding. They have to have strong leadership, the best and brightest from within the ranks of CDC and the Commission Corps. They have to have incentives and career pathways so that when they go out to these regional offices and they're in that leadership position, they know what that may lead to next. Say a bit about this. You've been in that world. How do we make it successful?
Right. So, you know, these offices, when they were developed, were meant to be relatively lean, not large numbers of staff, but it's very important to have the right staff. And it's very important to identify leaders that can represent CDC and develop strategy and manage people and also understand be excellent diplomats, but really understand how you need to address problems, not just in a country, but from a cross-country perspective or a regional perspective.
So, Mitch, what is needed in order to create an effective and reliable career pathway?
So HHS doesn't have the same kind of career pathway that agencies like State Department have. And I think it would be important because right now, if a CDC staff wants to do overseas work, you don't know what your long-term trajectory is. And there are things that we could put in place for training, to have FTEs at headquarters, to have guaranteed funding for overseas positions that's not dependent just on programs, to have landing spots back at headquarters that you could have, you know, productive work back at headquarters to be able to bring the knowledge from the field back to headquarters, and then to be able to go overseas in kind of a guaranteed, predictable way that you could bring your knowledge from headquarters back overseas. And there's not really that system in place to have guaranteed positions both overseas and at headquarters.
What's the significance of the decision that CDC Director Rochelle Walensky made in the last year to create a new position, a deputy director of CDC? It's never existed up to now. Charged with global affairs. Howard Zucker has been appointed. He's in place. What's the significance of that?
I think it's very important because it's an acknowledgement that global health is critical for the U.S. government to achieve domestic health security. And it's also an acknowledgement, I think, that policy and strategy is a critical part of global health. I think that the programs that we're doing are absolutely critical, and you know, we can't stop those, but we must add a policy and strategy layer. And that's both for CDC, but it's also for interagency of the U.S. government and relating to regional bodies and with other countries. You know, it's important that CDC be at the table in U.S. government discussions about global health policy and strategy. And I think having a deputy director position like that allows that to happen easier.
What's the resistance to these regional offices? What's the argument against them?
I have heard some resistance to them, and that's mainly that they would supplant country offices.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the intention was always that country offices would remain and are absolutely critical for CDC work, and that there's no replacement really for those day-to-day interactions that you have between in-country CDC staff and Ministry of Health staff or embassy staff or other partners. So it's not to supplant those, but it's to supplement them. So that's one. And the other is that unless you have programmatic funding, you won't really have influence. And it's very important that the offices overseas have the mandate to develop a regional policy and to develop regional strategy and to oversee the implementation of that and the effective use of resources. And if that's done, then I think they'll be very effective.
Thank you. Let's talk for a moment about an issue that's dear to you, which is the need for much more integration globally of early detection and surveillance. There's been a lot of work in that area. You've been very involved in that. These regional offices have some piece of that potentially, but it reaches well beyond that. What's your thinking on what has to happen now to improve the early detection and surveillance globally? And there's all these different hubs, all these different initiatives, some of which expanded very dramatically and some of them are deflating very dramatically. What's your take?
As you say, there's a lot of different initiatives. A lot of countries are involved. A lot of donors are involved. There's a lot of stakeholders that understand that to prevent the next pandemic, we need early detection and to have good global response. And I think that there's a lot of different aspects to early detection and surveillance. There's on the ground, primary care, public health surveillance, and we shouldn't lose sight that without having that, I don't think we're going to have a good global early detection and surveillance system. And so that's core public health workforce strengthening and implementing programs on the ground. And it's easy to kind of forget that that needs to remain in place and needs to be built. Then there are things like data analysis, you know, bioanalytics, genomic surveillance. And there's a lot of exciting developments in that area, and that needs to be developed and fostered and then incorporated into some kind of global early detection and early warning system.
Some of this is getting negotiated out in the International Negotiating Body, the pandemic.
So the pandemic treaty, right? It's being discussed there. There's the new Berlin hub in WHO, and they had a great launch at the World Health Assembly this year. And I have a lot of hope for it. And I hope that countries and donors will really support it to do the role that it could. There is no really international coordinating body, and there needs to be, I think, some strengthened international coordination on early detection and response. I think that there does need to be bilateral work, but there also needs to be, you know, some better coordination in this area.
What's the U.S. leadership role in this, do you think?
Well, the U.S. always has an opening to be a global leader in public health, and they are working to be, you know, an important player in this area. There's the Center for Forecasting and Analytics. They're strong in the...
At CDC.
And they're strong in the INB, and the interagency is playing a strong role in developing kind of policies and strategies. I hope they will support the Berlin Hub. And I also hope that they would support strengthening the role of the private sector. I think the private sector has a very important role to play in global public health. We learned that again in COVID with the development of vaccines. And I think we could have something similar in early detection and in surveillance.
Is this something, when you say private sector, are you referring to groups like Illumina, who are very big in the genomic sequencing worldwide and have been very vocal about the need for a more integrated, coherent strategy?
Yeah, there's a number of companies working in genomics,
yes,
laboratory, even in public health strengthening, but that need to be at the table when these global policies and strategies are discussed and be part of the solution. And I think they can be. I think that there's issues on both sides. The public sector tends to not necessarily trust the private sector. And there are issues with like data protection and data security that need to be addressed. And then the private sector needs to be a trusted collaborator and not only be transactional, but also work on global policy and strategy. And I think that's a good business decision for companies. So that's something that I would like to see that I think is necessary to go to the next level of pandemic prevention and preparedness and response, which is public-private partnership.
Is this something that we shouldn't really expect that WHO is going to lead on, given the barriers, given the fancy framework? And what you hear from the private sector is that they're basically cut out of all sorts of things. The barriers are just formidable, and they haven't seen much progress in trying to do that. So where do you imagine the forum, the ability to engage these private sector actors who are so fundamental to surveillance?
I think there's a few. I still am optimistic that WHO will start to do a better job of being able to incorporate private sector in their policy discussions and in their strategic discussions and in their technical discussions. And I think that that has to happen. And we worked with USG, and they still are, for a long time in trying to get WHO to kind of improve their FENSA process. And it still has a long way to go. I also think that organizations like G7 and G20 and other multilateral organizations could do a better job of incorporating the private sector. And that would be an example of positive results that then WHO might be able to be a little more open to working with the private sector.
Can we move now to talking about Rochelle Walensky's tenure as CDC director? Today is her last day in that role. She wrote a very, I thought, very eloquent and compelling set of reflections in the New York Times this week. She did an interview with Helen Branswell of STAT. We're actually publishing today a podcast that we did with Helen earlier this week. You worked with Rochelle as the chief medical officer. You retired back a year ago, June. Your cooling off period is over. You're now cool enough to talk about these subtopics. Share with us your reflections on what she was able to accomplish. It was a really tough period, a really challenging period of unprecedented levels of rancor, disinformation, trust has fallen, particularly among conservatives and Republicans, performance stumbles. It's just been a really difficult period. How would you grade her performance?
Yeah, I really admire Rochelle Walensky. I think she came in at an extremely difficult time, maybe the most difficult time ever for CDC, and really wanted to do the right thing. So one thing is CDC's reputation. Another is the response to COVID. Another is kind of internal organization. And she tried to address all of those and worked very hard on a daily basis to support staff, which we needed at that time because of what you mentioned. There were a lot of hits coming from all over. And also really assess what needs to change and try to change that at the same time. So do both at the same time, which is hard. And I think she was the right person to do that and had the right personality to do that and the right technical knowledge to do that.
So she started the Moving Forward program she announced in, I think, August 11th of last year. What's that been able to achieve up to now, do you think?
Well, I think internal organization and understanding what CDC's role is very important. You know, I think that the U.S. needs to see CDC as the United States Public Health Agency and support it to do that. And I don't think it necessarily has been. And that's something that needs to come from external, you know, from Congress, for example.
And the White House.
And from the White House. And it needs to be put in the right place as the U.S.'s public health agency. Internally, there are things that need to be done. And I think that she has acknowledged them. And I think the Moving Forward is one of the things. And I think it's very difficult to change culture. So you can change organization and you can change personnel. And it's very difficult to change culture. And I think that that takes a long time. And I think she's put it on the right direction to do that. So I admire her greatly for coming in at an extremely difficult time and taking on, you know, that very difficult role and moving it forward.
There's a few things that it seems to me are going to stand out as achievements of her tenure. She stepped forward in August in announcing this and in subsequent statements and admitted that CDC had made some major mistakes and that it needed to look inward and acknowledge those, own them, understand what had happened, and make corrective action. She put in place these processes. She called in these external experts who knew the agency well. She moved fast in illuminating 4 or 5 pathways of reform and then getting those to move forward. Not completed, but the speed of guidance has improved. That's been significant. We've seen some remarkable evidence of that in the reporting on MPOX around the world. There were initial stumbles, but I think by the fall, the performance was really proving CDC to be in the forefront. The Office of Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics, a major new initiative within CDC to get ahead of our ability to forecast, wastewater surveillance program that's now, I think, in 140 different sites around the country. I'm not sure what percentage of the U.S. population served, maybe 30, 40%, but in fairly quick order. Those seem to be some of the more important accomplishments.
I think they are. And I'm really happy that the Center for Forecasting and Analytics, which is based at CDC, but is really meant to serve the U.S. government, is getting stood up and has great leadership and is expanding. You know, again, I think the U.S. needs to have a public health agency for their own national security. It is the CDC. And so when we look at how it needs to be improved and where mistakes are, it shouldn't be identifying that there are mistakes so that the agency needs to be sidelined, saying there are mistakes so or there are weaknesses, let's make it as strong as we can. I think that has to be the focus for Congress and internally at CDC. One of the things that you hear is, should the CDC only focus on infectious disease response because it maybe had some weaknesses? And so if it just focused only on infectious diseases and didn't do any of the other work it did, it would somehow then be able to do better in infectious disease response. And I don't think those two things are connected. I think since the U.S. needs public health agency, and it is the CDC, it needs all the things that a public health agency does. You need it to work in diabetes, mm-hmm. and you need it to work in violence prevention, and you need it to work in environmental health. And at the same time, you can focus on what the weaknesses are in infectious disease preparedness response and fix that. I don't think it's one or the other.
Let's shift to Britain. You've been living in London, in the London area now for 7 months. This has been a tough time for the UK in terms of some of the leadership transitions from Boris Johnson to Truss to Sunak. Economies had some really difficult periods. We were seeing proliferation of strikes, comparisons of the early 80s period, cost of living, particularly in London. And in the background of all of this is the debate around attribution. How much of this can be tracked back to Brexit, the decision taken in the popular vote to depart the EU? And is this just the logical aftermath of a terrible decision, or is it something other than that? What's your reflections?
Yeah, so I've been there since early December. It's really striking how significant both the cost of living and the strikes have been. You know, there are frequent rail strikes around the country. They affect everybody's daily life, and you can't get places that you need to go sometime. Also, cost of living, you know, prices have gone up a huge amount. I'll give an example. My son lives in London and said that his real purchasing power has gone down 25% in the past year. And I think you can see that everywhere, and it's a major topic of discussion. In the time I was there, there were rail strikes, ambulance strikes, doctor strikes, nurses strikes, and airport strikes, in some ways crippling the country. At the same time, when you go around England, and we drove around a lot of England during that time and spent a lot of time in London, it is a vibrant, exciting, you know, living city and country with a lot going on. It's a huge public health center, and there's a lot of important groups that are active there or based there, CEPI, Gates, Google has a health office there, Wellcome Trust, UK government. There's a lot going on there in public health. And people are very optimistic that, you know, these crisis times will end and they'll be able to move on. And there's still a lot of great work going on there. There's a lot of discussion about how much of this was related to Brexit. I'm not a great person to be able to analyze that. I think the people who were against Brexit are convinced that this is a result of Brexit. And I think the people who were for Brexit think that this can be overcome without reversing Brexit. So I think it's something for us really to keep an eye on what's going to happen, because there's a lot of talk in the UK, but also in all of Europe, on how Brexit affected this.
The British government's been really supportive of the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian government during the war, second only to the United States, really, in significance. The British defense minister speaks very often to the media. They do almost daily briefings, the ministry, on what's happening. And they've made some decisions recently in terms of artillery and the like that go beyond the capacities we were comfortable giving Ukraine. Is the public standing with the government on the support in the Ukraine war?
It's hard to say. I think it's mixed. My impression is that it's mixed. And in general, there's a strong support for Ukraine and, you know, supporting Ukraine in any way possible. But the amount, especially given the economic crisis going on in the UK, that's where I think there's differing public opinion. But Rishi Sunak has been very strong with support for Ukraine.
And he's made some headway in repairing the relationship with Washington as well, it seems.
Yeah, I think so. My impression is that, you know, there's been a lot of turmoil in the government of the UK. And with Rishi Sunak, things are more stable, and he's been able to kind of develop a strategy and repair relationships. And in general, people feel a little calmer about where things are in the country.
We hosted the foreign secretary cleverly here a few months back, and his visit went very well.
Another impression I have there in the UK is that nobody wants more turnover. People want there to be kind of stability there, and that's necessary to kind of help the economy. And I think there's a feeling of general stability there now.
In terms of COVID and the COVID response, you know, we don't have a national commission here in the United States. There was a big effort led by Philip Zelikow, the COVID group, crisis group. I was part of that worked for quite a long time. Philip published The Lessons of the COVID War just recently, which has gotten a good reception, but there will be no national commission here in the United States, at least in the coming years. We may revisit it at a later point. In Britain, you're just seeing the start of a major government-backed analysis of what happened. They're starting to have hearings. It's quite a serious effort. Have you been watching that?
I haven't watched those yet. I know people who are testifying there in the UK about the hearings, but I haven't seen yet what's come out of it.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting to see because, you know, in the time that Philip's efforts were getting launched, there were discussions with the British with folks at Oxford, at the School of Government there, at Wellcome Trust, and elsewhere about this effort. And there was a sense that the style of investigation in Britain would be slower, take longer, be more government dominated, but it would unfold in time, a different style of investigation than we're accustomed to, like with the 9/11 Commission or some other national commission. So I think we're going to be watching this very carefully to see what comes out of it. The early hearings were done quite well.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that there'll be good information and it'll be generalizable beyond just the UK, I'm sure.
Yes. So we ask all of our guests to close by answering one question, which is, what gives you the greatest hope and optimism today with respect to the agenda that we all work around health security?
I think there's a huge international momentum for developing global systems for pandemic prevention and response. And I think that the multilateral nature of things like the INB are critical and are recognized. And I think that's very important that we have there's bodies that you can go to talk among all countries about this critical issue and get together. And so when I was at the World Health Assembly in May, it was the first sort of real World Health Assembly in several years where we had everyone together. And it engendered a huge feeling of optimism that we can all get together and talk about these issues in a forum. I mean, that's an amazing thing. And I think there's a lot of momentum now. I know that people are very worried about cycle of panic and neglect related to pandemics and global health. And I think I am worried that we're entering into more of a neglect cycle, but I don't think we're there. I think that there's a lot of momentum, and what needs to happen is there needs to be a lot of focus on where funding is going to go and where priorities are for pandemics, for climate and health, for global surveillance. And I think the beginnings are there. Like I said, we have the pandemic hub, we have this Center for Forecasting and Analysis, we have a lot of work going on in climate and health, but there needs to be more global coordination and agreement that there's coordination, and countries and foundations and donors have to give themselves up to more coordination. So that's where I see the biggest global need, but I'm also optimistic that there's a possibility for that.
Thank you so much, Mitch. Thanks for everything you do, and thanks for taking the time to be with us.
No, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Common Health. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a follow and leave a review. To learn more about the CSIS Bipartisan Alliance for Global Health Security or listen to other CSIS podcasts, please visit csis.org.